Hi listeners. This is Stephen Hawking. I was working on cool math stuff, but I thought I'd take a moment to remind you that Infants on Thrones has been nominated for Best Religious Inspiration Podcast on PodcastAwards.com, so you should all totally go there and vote for them. Also, I think the Quorum guys are super cool and awesome and fun and funny and smart, and I'm a tiny bit intimidated by their pure animal magnetism. And for all you doubters out there, this is definitely the real Stephen Hawking and not just a text-to-speech voice emulator. Also, boobs. Teehee.
Welcome back to Infants on Thrones. I'm Bob Caswell, and today our guest is Trevor McKendrick, aka the Atheist Bible Salesman. Now, as you're about to hear, Trevor grew up Mormon before he found himself in this new state of disbelief that he's in now. And as a non-believer, who also happens to make a living selling Bibles, well, he's conflicted about it. Or is he? That's what we're going to explore in today's discussion. Trevor and I are also joined by Jake Frost, a.k.a. Brother Jake, and Randy Snyder, a.k.a. Randy. We did have some audio issues as Jake was in a snowstorm and Randy was traveling, but overall, God was merciful and allowed us to persevere. Just one more note, we aren't the first to find Trevor's story interesting. Just a few weeks back, Trevor had his 15 minutes of fame that culminated in a discussion of his situation on Fox News. And as fun as it can be to be in the spotlight, part of his story is also what it's like to have your disbelief story spread without much context or involvement on your part. But lucky for us, we like context and we like disbeliever involvement, and we have more than 15 minutes to talk about it. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Take it away, Trevor.
My name's Trevor McKendrick, and I'm a Bible salesman. Kind of. The week I got married in the Ochre Mountain Temple, I quit my job as an accountant in California and moved back to Salt Lake City. With a low-paying part-time job and my wife still in school, we needed more income. So I decided to make an iPhone app. I considered a couple of different ideas, but eventually stumbled upon the idea of making a Spanish-language Bible app. Not because I served my mission in Mexico, which, incidentally, I loved, but because it seemed like a good business opportunity. It turns out that at the time, there were quite a few Spanish Bible apps that looked really poorly made, but ranked well in the App Store, which meant they were making decent money. The thinking was that if these low-quality apps were doing well, maybe there was an opportunity there. My goal was just to pay our rent, $600 at the time. The app launched April 22nd, 2012. With zero marketing or promotion, the first month we did $1,500 in revenue. The second month, that more than tripled to $5,000. The app quickly changed from a side project to a full-time income. I used the extra profits to improve the app and to make other Bible apps. I also started attending book conferences to meet Christian publishers. I made licensing deals with these publishers so that we could sell their Christian ebooks to our customers too. Today, the business does great. I only have to spend a few hours a month in the company. It's a great gig, and I'm not complaining. So what's the rub? Well, as you might have guessed, I don't believe in God anymore and have long since left the LDS Church. And while I appreciate a few of the minuscule benefits of religion, I'm very confident that religion is a net negative in the world. It's like if you sold Harry Potter books to people, but told them that it was real, and that they too were wizards, and could learn to cast spells if they read and studied enough, and that their spells could potentially, if they were diligent wizards, cure even their own children's diseases. I think we'd all agree that that would be a terrible thing to do. And yet, here I am profiting off of religion. Sometimes it makes me feel like Rush Limbaugh.
We're the crazies.
While the apps won't make me wealthy, they do provide a great income and lifestyle that I can't justify turning off. And so it goes. Of course, there are worse things than being an atheist Bible salesman. Or at least that's what I hope people tell me when they find out what it is I do.
Why so serious?
Okay, so where I thought we'd start, Trevor, is you have quite the story, and we're going to splice it in, and at this point, listeners will have already heard it. So I thought it'd be good to contextualize it in a couple of different ways. And first up is, how much Mormon credibility do you have?
So, like everyone else, like I have my critiques of the test, right? So I think I took it, I don't know, a couple months ago. I think I got like a 65.
Okay.
Which was disappointing. But then I heard, I forget which one of your episodes, talked a lot about the importance of children, I think, in the Mormon experience, or how that should influence the scale. And I haven't had kids. And the more I thought about it, I was like, yeah, if I, you know, that would be like a whole new level of being Mormon. So I guess I'm not as high as I originally thought. But
65 is respectable. I mean, that's pretty good. So that means you've been through the temple, you've served a mission, probably you,
yep.
You can refrain from the sex question, but we'll just make our assumptions.
I'll tell you, I wish I had done more. Like, I wish I had taken advantage of my singlehood, but I wasn't.
Don't we all, man?
Yeah, exactly.
Don't we all? The old ball and chain.
Every night, the same. I'm just kidding.
So I'm wondering where you're lacking, because if you haven't had kids, and I'm the same, but I think not to rub it in, but my Mormon cred is like more like 80. So you're missing out on, like, you went to a church school. Do you come from a long line of Mormons? Were you delusional?
Yeah.
Do you
descendant of John Taylor? I mean, he has a lot, so it's not that cool. But I'm one.
No, that's good.
So I think the ones I missed where I was the most I ever got for callings was second counselor and elders quorum. So I, missed out on that one. And then the other one is I don't think I ever had visions of grandeur about being, anything in the church.
Well, that's like a give me. I mean, you could just lie on that one if you wanted. I mean,
I was like, I want to go back and like put yes for that one and see what I score. I don't know, but yeah, 65 and everything except for kids and the things I just mentioned, basically.
Yeah, I think it should be weighted by age, because, like, if you hit certain milestones, under 25, like, there's kind of a ceiling. I mean, unless you start having kids before then, but, you know, I think it should be weighted by age.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, you compensate for women who can only do so much. Like, you should compensate for
Yeah, women. I've already gotten plenty of sexist hate mail, and I get it. It's fine. I guess I should even explain this. For those who are new or haven't heard, I created this cred scale called Bob's Mormon Cred Scale, and that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, you know what? I say fuck that, because
it's Mormonism's fault.
It's ageist for a reason. I mean, people that didn't get out until they're 40 suffered so much longer than assholes.
That's true.
Who got out, figured this out because of the internet.
Yeah. No, you got a good point.
But to the point on women, even though they don't get the full Mormon experience in the way that the full Mormon experience is blatantly sexist and you don't get it if you're not a man, it still, like, affects them at the same level, if not more. So it's this weird tension, like, I want to represent that, but then I also want to just be like, no, that's just how it is. I mean, it's a reflection of the sexism that's built into the
system. It's kind of the point, isn't
right.
it?
It's like, yeah, okay, I'll trade my 10 points on the Mormon cred scale for another decade outside of Mormonism. All right, all right.
Yeah, that's a worth trade. That's a bargain. Yeah. So, so then tell us a little bit more about your personal timeline of school, work, marriage, crisis of faith. So, I mean, you did this thing where you quit regular real life and you started making money in a way more attractive, I'm super jealous of you way. And, how did that, but let's back up before that. What were your ideals in life and what did you choose for career and how were you raised and just speak to that kind of stuff for a second?
Sure. So my Mormon story is like very much not unique. Typical, very TBM, black and white, oldest of six household.
Okay.
Had questions, concerns, doubts, in, you know, 17, 18, still went to BYU, sort of mission in Oaxaca, Mexico, which I actually really liked. Went back, graduated from BYU with a bachelor's and a master's degree in accounting.
Both? You went the full accounting master's from BYU? That's like good stuff, man. That's like recognized even beyond, you know, BYU normally is this microcosm where they think they're super important, but they are actually with accounting, so that's cool.
Beyond the cred scale, even.
Is that Tanner building shit?
It is Tanner building shit.
Yeah, sure. Fucking, that's like the
box.
That's the GA factory.
Oh, totally.
I was at South Campus with all the science geeks.
Yeah, although the stupid joke on campus is that it's like the great and spacious building, but whatever. Yeah, so I graduated in accounting, because it was, you know, it was like the prestigious program in the business school at BYU, definitely helped get dates and all that fun stuff.
Really?
Totally. I mean, it's one of those inherent, or one of those things that people don't actually say, but like, you tell, I'm studying accounting, or I'm in the master's program, and, it ranks really well, or whatever, like, they've like heard about it, versus like, I'm studying, you know, God knows what, communications, and then you're screwed.
But it's kind of this weird cross section of like, accounting isn't known for, like, you know.
Yes, like, since when is accounting prestigious? Like, in what universe? Oh, in
right.
The Mormon.
For sexiness, it's not like really associated with.
Totally. And it turns out that studying accounting is totally different than actually doing accounting. It's miserable actually doing it. So, anyways, I mean, I don't know how many details you guys want to hear, but I worked for an auditing firm called KPMG in the Bay Area in Northern California for about a year.
Yeah.
Incidentally, was writing my now wife, who was serving a mission in the great city of Ogden, Utah.
Home of my forefathers.
Oh, really? Yeah.
We'll refrain from all sorts of jokes on what that means to be called to Ogden, Utah. But
yeah, well, I was at BYU at the time. Anyway, that's a whole other story. But yeah, I actually like helped set her apart with her family.
Whoa,
like,
wow.
Right in front of them and the whole thing. That was embarrassing. And then, worked up there and actually arranged with the firm. So I'm kind of proud of this, but arranged with the firm to get – because she was going to come back to BYU to finish school after her mission. So I actually convinced the firm to give me a 4-month leave of absence for 20% of my salary to move back to Provo so that I could date my wife, basically.
What? Wow. It was run by Mormons, right?
No. So
no,
this
KPMG
is like a world
is
firm
amazing.
In California,
yeah.
With a bunch of liberals. So really? I think my best guess, because the only other leave of absence they would give was like a month to like for people to like study for the CPA exam, which obviously important to the firm. But they gave me 4 months, and the only reason I can come up with is that they thought it was like some like taboo, can't object on his religion type thing. Like, oh,
yeah,
got to
right.
Do this. So
wow. But the seeds of manipulating the system such that you get paid and don't have to really work, that started pretty early for you then.
I think it would have started a lot younger if I wasn't raised in such a black and white household. Because I've all, yeah. Ugh. But yeah, I guess it started then.
Have you said where you grew up?
I grew up in a suburb of Los Angeles near Pasadena.
Oh, wow. Hey, I grew up in L.A. too. How's the L.A. Mormon scene? Is it like – it's not quite Arizona, Idaho, but it's still pretty dense, isn't it, or not?
Well, in high-income places like Temple City, La Cañada, Arcadia – the church is still pretty strong, like Glendale, or not Glendale, Glendora.
Yep.
But in like where I grew up, it is contracting. Like our stake is just folding in on itself. What used to be like 5 wards where I grew up is now 1 that my dad's in, which is the ward I grew up in. So in LA County overall, it's completely folding in on itself.
That's kind of happening in our home state too, where it's too expensive, so all the young people are moving out.
Right. They're moving to Arizona. Like yep. Many of my siblings and myself, you know, at one point, Nevada, Idaho, you know, they're basically it's the cost
cheaper
of living.
Mormon capitals.
Right. So the average age in Mormons in Southern California is going up and up and up.
Oh, wow.
Because, okay. If you bought a house like 30 years ago, you're set.
Right. Okay, so it's not like an activity issue. It's not like all people are seeing, you know,
no,
what the Mormon
it's not
really
like high attrition rates that people are moving away.
Yeah.
Okay. So Trevor, one question I had for you in relation to your career choice or your schooling, not to make it about me, but I'm just curious, is there anything about Mormonism that got you into accounting in terms of, you know, how practical it is and the fact that there's high placement rates and it's just sort of this guarantee that it's like, sure, it's super boring, but who cares? I'm just going to get an awesome job. And I ask this because my own experience, I mean, I went to business school as an undergrad and then I got an MBA and, you know, people normally, or at least I assume, try to figure out what their passions are in life. But for me, I just looked at like, okay, what's the best return on investment? What's the easiest way for me to like just be set in life and make money? And I'm wondering if that was just me or if there's, I want to say there's something larger because I think Mormonism helps facilitate that, but I could just be making that up and I'm curious how it was for you.
Yeah. So like a lot of people, I would totally do college differently.
now.
Yeah. I don't know how, I don't know how much to attribute it to Mormonism, but my thinking process was very similar to what you just described, where BYU's accounting program has something like a 97% job placement. I didn't know, unfortunately, I didn't know what jobs they were talking about when I would graduate, but I knew I would have a job.
Right.
And it had, you know, it ranked well, it had this prestige. I just knew that if I got into the program and I graduated, I would have a job. And that was the extent of my analysis, to be honest. This is maybe kind of obvious for all of us, but I've like changed a lot since then in my thinking. And I would go back and just be more curious about the world in college than I would be like, studying accounting is just terrible. Like what a waste of an important time of discovery in your life.
Right.
Yeah, you probably, if you went back, would take more philosophy courses.
Yeah. I mean, I would have just stayed for an extra couple of years and it's so cheap and taken a bunch of random classes. Right. Like, but at the time it was just, I know I'll get a job if I do this. So that's what I did.
I guess maybe not to put too fine of a point on it, because I might be backfilling something or placing blame where it's not really fair. But I feel like there's this sort of passion for exploitation of just what's available. Like I've read and seen a lot of how you came to where you came with your business idea, and it's kind of this like, you know, where's the hole in the market? You know, who cares if I'm selling cigarettes to children? It doesn't matter if there's like an opportunity and it's legal. You know, and I don't mean to overstate it, because we'll get to this whole like moral/ethical dilemma, if there is one, if there isn't. But I'm just wondering if you feel like you were ironically prepped to go for that sort of thing because you didn't really have a real passion. Your passion was looking for, you know, how to just manipulate systems or find holes in places. That's how I feel. But again, I don't mean to project it on you so much.
Yeah, I hear porn's really lucrative too, actually.
Right. And it's legal.
Yes.
Like if you pay a woman to have sex with you, but you don't put a camera in front of it, it's illegal. Put a camera in front of it,
it's
totally
all
legal.
Good. Yeah.
I hadn't thought about that. Thank you, Randy.
Randy prostitution tip number 3.
Yeah, he's Randy orthodontist, sure. I take it as a compliment, to be honest, because I wasn't hacking the system as much as I was just going through you know, looking at all the different programs and figuring out which one led to the most desirable result at the end of the program. Kind of like I was saying earlier, I think one of the big differences between, or why a lot of people aren't entrepreneurs, is because there's no checklist, there's no guide to starting a brand new business or brand new anything. But in school, there totally is. You just follow the syllabus and then you get your degree and your job. So I just picked the major that I thought would give the most, you know, desirable outcome when I graduated. I don't think it was like hacking or exploiting the system at all. I wish I had done something like that, but I don't think I did.
Okay, yeah, so that came later.
Well, I can speak to that though, because you guys may have noticed that no matter where you move in America, there's a disproportionate amount of Mormon dentists where you live. I still remember being in class with Bill Bradshaw in cell biology class, and he was just ranting in front of the 250 people in his cell biology class, saying, "If I can just convince one of you to get out of pre-med or pre-dent and get your PhD and do research, I will have succeeded." But everyone in that class, you know, wanted to become a dentist or a physician, and most, you know, more often it was a dentist. And so I've thought about this for a long time. Why are there so many goddamn Mormon dentists? Because no matter where I move, I've been in Phoenix, Kansas City, now Denver, and I'm surrounded by Mormon dentists, like surrounded. And the reason why, I think, is like if you are Mormon, and this is what Trevor's talking about, like you want to plug into something where you don't have to be unusually lucky or unusually clever to almost guarantee a six-figure income. And why would you want that? Because you want, and not only that, you're not like a prisoner of some corporation where you're working 80 hours a week. You want to have time with your family, time to do your calling, preferably be a bishop, and have your wife stay at home because you make enough. Dentist is the perfect job for a Mormon.
Yep.
And that's why I was drawn to it. I'll be honest. That's why I was drawn to it.
Interesting. So that's, I don't know how to square that with my experience in Utah, because I'm almost the opposite. Before I decided to get an MBA, I did a bunch of small business stuff, and I started a couple of my own companies, and I made some decent money, but nothing that I could like retire off of, like the dream, you know. But it was mostly services based. I was in IT consulting, and from what I understand, it's only grown since then. Like, Utah has a decent entrepreneurship sort of epicenter going on, at least relative to what you guys are saying. So I'm curious, Trevor, if that's just totally unrelated, or if you know anything about that, or if that's just your opinion on that, independent of picking the safe route, like what Randy's talking about.
My opinion on like Utah's entrepreneurship scene?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, I'll speak. I guess these days entrepreneurship and tech, I think, are commingled quite a bit.
Right.
And since I'm in the tech space, that's kind of what I know. But Utah's always, I mean, in a lot of places kind of do this, but Utah's kind of claimed, you know, basically since Novell to be kind of a tech
right.
hub alternative to Silicon Valley.
Right.
And that's they've had a lot of successes, but it's becoming like more and more true and much more recognized kind of in the Bay Area and other places, kind of just barely. It is known, and people like to make the Mormon missionary sales joke, and I don't think that's actually necessarily true, but Utah is more known as a strong sales and marketing place. So very B2B, very enterprisey type software, like Omniture is a good example of that.
Yeah, that got bought by Adobe, yeah.
Exactly. And so, anyways, to answer your question, yeah, I don't know if that's related to Mormonism or not, but it's up and coming little brother entrepreneurship scene. It has some street cred. This 2014 in particular was a remarkably good year as far as number of venture capital dollars raised in Utah.
Right.
But we'll see if that was just a lucky thing or if it's continuing, but it's got a, if you want to do tech entrepreneurship in Utah, you can definitely do it.
Okay. Okay, but you're not comfortable, at least at this point, saying that there's a connection to Mormonism. I feel like there might be, like Mormonism facilitates this this, you know, fueling of capitalism and freedom and going, like, there's almost like this cross section of Mormonism, at least since Correlation got popular, because it's ironic because it sort of did a 180. But nowadays, like, there's almost like a libertarianism sort of vibe going on, at least with some of my friends and people who are still in Utah who are doing their own thing and doing businesses. I don't know. Maybe I'm reaching too far.
I mean, there's like a self-reliance independence thing from Mormonism that I think drives it quite a bit. And so you have on one side, you have the entrepreneurs who are totally doing their own thing and, blazing their own paths. And on the other side, you have also successful people, the dentists and the lawyers who've done the checklist and are successful. And then in the middle, you have everyone who's like suffering through corporate America.
like Office Space.
Which is like people. The largest portion of the population, basically.
Yeah. And by far. So motherfucking miserable.
About that.
Well, yeah, I mean, oh God, like, oh, so KPMG, our biggest client that I worked on was Adobe. So we work out of Adobe's offices in San Jose, and
yeah, which is where I am now, just like down a few blocks from me.
Oh yeah, I should have said hi back then, but I mean, I would work. So our busy season is we would do their audit. So whenever their year end was like November 31st, which is a weird year end. And so we worked through like the Christmas season through February. And I remember I only had to do it 1 year, thankfully, because I bailed. But after that, my first year, I didn't get a single day off in the entire month of February, Saturday, Sundays, the whole thing. Saturdays and Sundays working 8 hours, Monday through Friday working 12 plus hours. And the bad thing about accounting or auditing is that it's like investment banking, but without the money and prestige. And so, I mean, I was only making like $50,000, no bonuses.
You're working accounts for millionaires, right?
Well, I mean, we were auditing Adobe's books. So, I mean, the millionaires in the building were the executive team, who I didn't even really see, and the partners. And honestly, the partners have miserable jobs too. I mean, they might be wealthy, but you could make just as much being a dentist and have a much better life.
Right.
Yeah, accounting and auditing was just – I don't have words to describe how awful it was. And I knew from my internship there for 3 months during school that it was going to be a bad fit, but I didn't know what else to do at the time. I was still in the church, so I didn't have the balls to leave that. I didn't have the balls to leave the accounting track, and so I did it basically for a year and a half and saved up some money.
You were checking a box. It's an offer. You got a good salary, at least straight out of college, and why wouldn't you take it? Did you have any other alternatives? No, right?
Yeah, I mean, and that's kind of the difference between me now and me then. So I didn't have any alternatives, so I just did it. So I quit the job literally the week I got married in California and moved out to Utah. I got married and had literally one part-time job lined up for 10 hours a week, paying me $15 an hour, which is right when I got married. And the difference in myself then and from when I started the job is I just knew that I would figure it out. I was like, every extra day down this path is a day in the wrong direction that I know I don't want to get any further down that rabbit hole. And so regardless of whatever, the stupid object lesson in seminary, like the train tracks, you can only stay on one track. You guys remember that, where they branch off?
Yeah.
Right.
Anyway, I had to switch tracks. I was comfortable going into the, kind of the unknown at that point.
Okay. So how long did you stay at Adobe and then give us a sense of how things were going with where you were with Mormonism and your marriage or your pending marriage, sure. if I get it right.
I always had questions. I graduated in 2010. In 2008, I'd actually decided I didn't believe it anymore. And I called up some of my atheist friends from high school and chatted with them and felt good.
2008. Wow. That's earlier.
Yeah. And made the gray. Well, I made the mistake of like telling people because I was at BYU. I like told my home teacher.
You told people at BYU? Why would you do that?
I prefaced it. I said I made a mistake. I mean, I admit.
did you get called to the honor code office?
I didn't, and I don't know why. Maybe it's because I told my bishop, or I told my home teacher, and eventually it got to my bishop, and he gave me a calling. I think it was like the secretary in the elders quorum presidency, like, and that was terrible. So I stopped doing that.
That'll fix you.
And I really, yeah. But the single.
He's in accounting.
The single largest mistake that I made was that I told this girl, who we were just friends at the time, but we ended up dating, and she ended up breaking up with me because of the Mormon issue. And I really liked her, and it was just awful. It was just, you know, I remember calling my dad, like yelling at him, like, why did you raise me Mormon? Yeah, I mean, I was upset. My life has been negatively impacted, and so
a girl dumps me, and you call your dad and say, "God damn it, why'd you raise me Mormon?" that wouldn't even occur to me. I would have been looking at myself like, "Oh, I need to repent. I need to be more righteous."
Next step in Trevor's storyline, right, is I did that exact thing where basically I. My next life mission was to prove to her that I believe in Mormonism, and that was bad. So I would send her notes every Sunday that I'd taken during like church.
That's great.
And you know, things along that line, and it was really bad. And so basically, we didn't end up dating again. We kind of ended up making out a couple more times. But eventually, because of her, I convinced myself to believe in Mormonism again, and did so for the next couple of years. So let's see, timeline-wise. So then that was 2008, 2010, I graduate. I go into my first singles ward outside of BYU in California. And in 2011, I get married, and a couple months later, leave the church. And so basically what happened is – I realized that I hadn't believed the church like this entire time. Like, I remember, like, oh yeah, back in BYU and even during my mission, like, I'd always have questions and doubts. And then basically once I got married, two things happened. And one was that, I got married. So the only reason I'd gone to church this whole time was because of the social life, right? And church is miserable. Like 3 hours is just awful. Oh. And then as soon as there was no good reason, no like girls to meet or no one to like socialize with, it was like, why am I going to church? Was number one. And then number two was my younger brother left the church. He had a mission call to Germany, and then like a month before decided not to go. And we had no idea that each other had questions. And so
I've been there too, yeah.
Yeah, we bonded over that, and so I was like comfortable leaving at that point.
Wait, but you only share what you're comfortable sharing, but you already had a crisis of faith years before you got married, but then you sort of swept it under the rug, and then you really left like literally months. It wasn't even years, months after you got married. And how does your wife fit into this and her relationship with the church and with you? And you got married in the temple. It just seems like
right.
Super
Didn't
fast.
You set her apart? Didn't you set her? You said you set her apart before she left on her mission, right?
That's correct. That was in September of 2009. Correct.
Right. Your wife is a return missionary, and you leave 2 months after the marriage. Okay, come on, explore that.
I think my last day of church was 6 months after I got married. So it's not, you know, I don't know. It's still not long, but it's longer than 2 months.
Right.
Part of me, I'm just like a douchebag, and my wife is just a gloriously flexible individual. Here's the thing. When we were dating, when we were engaged, she'd always been a more, not liberal Mormon, but like I could tell that she didn't like conform to all the rules that I thought were like the typical Mormon rule. I thought she was like flexible. I thought she would be okay with me leaving. And you got to understand, like when she left on her mission, I was like devastated. And even though I dated other girls when she was gone, like that year and a half was like me thinking about her and arranging my life around her. And so when she got back, it was like, of course we're going to get married. Of course, you know, I don't really like the church anymore, but this is what I've been doing. If we don't marry, it's going to be like, I would be devastated.
Did you fake it then a little bit, or is that not a fair characterization?
Say that again.
Did you like fake it in terms of like the actual going through the temple and doing what you're supposed to do, but you kind of knew already that like I don't know about this or is so, that?
Yeah, no, totally. We had one talk about it when we were engaged or right before we got engaged, and it was just like so mortifying to both of us that we didn't even address it again, and we just basically got married. And her and I have talked about this since, and we're like, what the hell were we thinking?
This has something to do with something you said earlier. I guess you expressed something that maybe it's the same thing that I've heard expressed other places, but you said it in a way that I'd never heard it before, where you said you convinced yourself to believe in the church again.
Yeah.
What does that mean? Like in kind of specifically, like is it just you kind of double down on the activity or on the participation side or going through the motions or doing the actions, or you actually convinced yourself to put aside your doubts?
It was all of the above. It was reading basically reading the Book of Mormon more and focusing on as much evidence in favor of the church as possible, while also telling myself that if it is not true, I would still live a good, happy life and have good children and all that kind of stuff. So looking for ways to reinforce the belief as much as possible, while also kind of hedging my bets, saying I would be happy even if I was wrong. And so like the specific evidence that I would look for, like, for example, I still have like a replica of the original Book of Mormon. Right. And so I would read that and, tell myself that there's no way Joseph Smith could have written it. I'd look like Alma. I still remember Alma chapter 36. I forget what it's called, but it's like an example of the Hebrew way of writing where like the chapter like collapses on itself and it repeats itself in the middle outwards to the end.
Yeah.
And anyways, yeah, kind of stuff like that.
Well, right, Jake, right. This is a perfect example of you can choose your behaviors, but you cannot choose your beliefs. I don't think you. I mean, eventually, I mean, it didn't even take long. your beliefs are your beliefs, and your behaviors can influence them, but eventually, it's like trying to take a broom to the tide.
Mm. I don't know. And then going back to the point where I think we were at the point where you had this conversation with your fiance right before you got married, but you're so embarrassed that you just said, fuck it, we'll get married anyway.
In so many words, yes.
Yeah.
And I was still kind of innocent, to be honest, right? I mean, I made a sex joke on accident in our ceiling, right?
What?
In the temple.
wait, on accident?
No joke. No joke, guys.
So, was it?
It was, and I have people who can back me up. So, the crowd's in there and the sealer's there and he's talking and he says, I bet a lot of things have been on your guys' mind lately. And me thinking about getting married was like, oh no, just one thing's been on my mind, right? And the whole place erupts into temple hushed laughter. And I'm like, well, it wasn't like that funny, right?
It was. For Mormons, that's
pretty hardcore, yeah.
So anyway, I've come a long way since then. But it was kind of just my mindset at the time. And I mean, I remember getting upset with the sealer and with like the temple president in the temple because they were like asking weird questions. And I was like, I knew at that point, at least, that this was all kind of a facade, right? It wasn't real, but not enough to actually leave yet.
But you sort of swallowed it down and just,
I had to get married. I had to get the girl like that. Like, I stayed in the church because of a girl, and I stayed in the church even more because of my wife.
This speaks volumes to your wife, by the way. I mean,
yeah,
this should really stroke her ego.
I don't know if she sees it that way, but
yeah, she says she does pride herself on being flexible. So I guess there's that. And anyway, yeah, we got married December of 2011. My business started in April of 2011, and I left. My last day of church was probably June or July of my business started in April of 2012, and my last day of church was probably June or July of 2012.
Wow. So it was all pretty compressed. And then how did you navigate leaving with your wife? Did she sort of say me too, or I'm flexible, I'm not into it either, or was it kind of the timing wasn't quite aligned like so easily?
So she is, or was, I don't know, was a very social Mormon, and like I would say many Mormons who aren't interested in whether it's true, but they're interested in the alleged benefits, right, of
hanging out, purpose
and values and a social structure and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so when I stopped going, she was going by herself, and she didn't like that like at all for a second.
Right.
And so I don't know, 3, 4, 5, maybe 6 months later. I mean, we were teaching primary. And so at first she had stopped going to sacrament. She'd just teach primary. Then she would like call in to get a sub 1 week. And then eventually we moved, we changed wards. And that was when she like stopped altogether. Go ahead.
I'm just curious because my wife hated Mormonism, and it took me 6 months to convince her. And like your wife was a return missionary, and like she just got on board with you, right? Pretty quick.
Yeah, well, this speaks a lot to our marriage, frankly. But she doesn't always know what she wants. She kind of like adapts to what other people around her want, which frankly I don't like. We've talked a lot about. And it actually worries me a lot as far as Mormonism goes, because she, even though she's quote unquote left, she doesn't wear garments, she doesn't go to church, she hasn't left for her own reasons yet. And so, you know, it's one of the reasons we haven't had kids yet, because frankly, I'm afraid that at some point she'll like switch whenever she figures it out, whatever side she ends up landing on, we don't know what that's going to be. Mm. And so I don't know. It's weird because I would say it's been quote unquote better than a lot of one-legged couples where one person leaves, but at the same time, it's still very much not resolved yet.
Mm. She doesn't listen, right?
What do you mean she doesn't listen?
What do you mean by that? Whoa.
Well, does she have a black eye or something, huh, Randy?
No, I'm just saying he was being like brutally honest, and I love it.
Yeah,
but,
you mean she doesn't listen to Infants on Thrones. That's what you mean.
Oh, no, when I do in the car.
No, did you guys think she doesn't?
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
Oh,
she doesn't listen,
no.
Does she?
I'm sorry. I meant, okay, let me add, she doesn't listen to Infants on Thrones, right? Because you're being brutally honest here and painting an unfaithful, like you painted her originally as like this woman that you had to have. You were willing to self-flagellate yourself in Mormonism to have her. And then you painted this really brutally honest and really quite endearing picture of your wife. But at the same time, I'm like, man, if she listens to this, well, maybe you guys have talked about it. I don't know.
Well, I was just gonna say we've talked about all of this. So it's nothing new. She knows that she's in this case molded to, you know, my new belief system, you know, and she, to her credit, focuses on the things that she likes. You know, she likes not wearing garments, you know, she likes not having to go to all 3 hours of church. I think she would listen to all the stuff I just said and be like, yeah, like, so what? Like, we know all of that.
Okay.
Well, that's pretty cool. Okay. So let's fast forward a little bit, and Trevor, tell us how you got to the point where you were interested in creating this business and how that played in with your disaffection and how it all just came together as we know the story now.
So I had an interest kind of like you described, Bob, in entrepreneurship and doing something on my own for a while. And even when I worked in accounting, on the few nights I had available, I'd come home and work on random projects. And so when I quit accounting and got married, all of a sudden I had a ton of time available. And so I started working on a couple of projects, all of which sound crazy. For example, and it turns out there's a lot of businesses that do this, but I wanted to take Americans to my mission in Oaxaca and teach them Spanish immersively, because my Spanish got to be pretty good, and I was like, there's no better way to learn than immersion. So I started working on that for a little bit. And then the other, you know, this other project was my Spanish language Bible app. And at this time, again, it was kind of the cognitive dissonance that occurred when I got married. It was like, I didn't really believe, but it was just a business opportunity. I didn't really think about any moral implications, and I had no idea that it would be as big as it is today. And basically, I looked through apps in the App Store that because they rank apps by how much their revenue they're bringing in by their gross revenues, and I just looked for apps that were bad,
right?
That looked crappy, but that were ranked well, which meant they were making good money. And it turned out there was quite a few Spanish language Bible apps like that. Mm-hmm. And I served Spanish speaking, and it kind of just made sense. I mean, I don't know how many things you want to hear about like the business itself, but. You know, the first month the app made like $1,500. Second month it made $6,000. It's kind of grown ever since.
Wow. So what kind of runway did you have, and what sort of pressure? I mean, you're a newlywed, you're quitting your job, you're doing the wrong things in terms of the Mormon story.
Sure.
So did you have any money in the bank, or did you really feel like, okay, I got to figure shit out, or else we're going to be out on the street or living with my parents and 2 months.
Oh yeah, that would have been that's not an alternative for me, because I will never live with my parents. But I had, when I quit KPMG, when I got married, I had like just under $10,000 in the bank. I had that part time job that was basically paying our rent. My wife had a part time job at BYU. We lived in the ghetto in Salt Lake City, so we could basically pay our bill. We were like net zero, like income to expenses. Mm-hmm. And I was okay with that. And the job I had taken was kind of a strategic job, where, and this is the way I explained it to my father-in-law, where it was low cash, but it was high value. And so, and the reason for that was because the job was actually with Weber State and the state of Utah. And I was helping small businesses win state business grants. And the way it was set up is I didn't have an office. I didn't have to be anywhere. I was very flexible. And so I was able to meet a lot of entrepreneurs and a lot of business people through this job. And so and many of those relationships have continued over to today. But the whole idea was, you know, if I'm going to do this entrepreneurship thing, let's at least, you know, meet some people who've done it before. You know, we're not going to go broke. You know, we have money in the bank. We have, you know, we can pay our expenses. And let's just kind of roll the dice. We're young, and let's figure something out. And that was my mindset.
Nice. So you actually had a decent safety net, not really a safety net, but you had, like you said, you were at least breaking even to the point where you had some flexibility or some runway, which is really nice. It's not like you were going to go broke in a couple months and it was all or nothing.
Yeah. No, I mean, people say entrepreneurs are like risk adverse, and I wouldn't describe myself that way at all. I like to minimize risk while maximizing whatever, you know, my return, maximize, you know, potential opportunities, I guess.
Yeah. I hear you. I feel like I'm in the same boat of being the paradox of a cautious entrepreneur, which is like, what's that?
Sure.
I think that grows out of the myth of the business built out of a garage and stuff, where most of the time that doesn't happen. Most businesses are built while people are working at other businesses.
Yes.
That's probably true. Yeah.
Most entrepreneurs meet each other in the same company and then say, hey, we can start. And then they start working on something on the side. And then eventually kind of they make a leap at some point. There's some risk, of course, but it's, you know, it's I think a lot of them are hedging their bets in that way in the initial stages anyway.
Yeah, I'm totally against people that are like, oh, I want to quit my job and start a company. It's like, whoa, you do not have to quit your job to try something.
Right.
Like, and to your point, Jake, a lot of some of the best entrepreneurs start companies that are in the same industry as their previous employer, because they have all the relationships, they have all the industry knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I frankly, sometimes I wish I had worked somewhere for 5 or 10 years to kind of leverage that. I totally agree with you there.
Okay. Yeah. So let's talk about the first time you started feeling any sense of guilt or, you know, reflection on this conflict of like, hey, I'm making money from something I don't believe in, because the way I've heard you tell the story, and I've read a bunch of your media interviews / you know, write-ups, it seems like you were conflicted based on the scale and size that it became, but somehow if it was below a certain amount and, hey, I'm just paying my rent, then you weren't conflicted, at least in your mind. So I'm wondering if you could speak to that logic or lack thereof or whatever it was.
Well, it's like a lot of things in life, and especially business, where looking back, things seem as if they could not have gone any other way. Like there was a destiny and there's like this narrative that we tell ourselves. Right. Mm-hmm. And so looking back, it's like, you know, people think I should have had like this elaborate thought process or that I've, you know, I thought this decision through, but it was like, no, it was like at the time it was like, you know, one of five different projects that I was working on. I didn't know what, sure. I know. I was living in Rose Park, Salt Lake City. I was just like trying to make something happen. And I didn't know it was going to be, you know, six figure business. I didn't know that it was, I had no idea it was going to be. I was like, let's just, this might work. And my definition for might work at the time was like pay our $600 rent.
Yeah.
It like the moral question was like, didn't even enter my brain because like, it just, I mean, I don't know, $600. Like, I mean, yeah, it didn't, and I didn't think that like, it didn't even enter my mind that, oh, if this makes above, you know, X number of dollars that, oh, then I might be concerned. Like it didn't even remotely get to that. It was just, this is a side project that I'm working on. And that was the extent of my quote unquote logic.
Yeah.
So was any guilt you felt kind of proportionate to the amount of attention that it received? Did it kind of scale in the same way, or did one lead the other, or what?
No, it's more honestly, most of the guilt, most of the me thinking about it comes from, and I think I've mentioned this in other podcasts or write ups or whatever, but it comes from like the emails that I get from people, because you know when people are downloading your app and they're buying stuff inside the app, you don't I mean, it's obvious, but I have no idea who these people are. I don't interact with them. I don't see them. But then I get an email in Spanish. You know, that's like, oh, can you pray for my son because he has XYZ disease? And it's just like, oh, mother of God. Like, I
remember, oh, man.
Like, I remember, you know, so with the caveat that these people can't be too destitute because they have iPhones. But at the same time, I remember, maybe this sounds weird, but I hold my mission like very near and dear to my heart.
Sure.
And I really jived with the Mexican people. I spoke Spanish really well. I'm really sure I'm 5'4" and they, you know, and I just fit in with them and they liked me and I liked them. And so when I get these emails from people, you know, there's 100 people that I can think of in Oaxaca and my mission that person could be. And if, you know, if you're emailing some random app maker to get help with your son's whatever disease, like you're probably not in a great place. And so that honestly is where 95% of the guilt comes from. It's like, oh man, these people are looking to me for help. And they have no idea what.
So what do you do? Do you have a few options. You ignore, you write back honestly, you write back dishonestly, or you refer them to somebody.
For a long time, I would write
a prayer hotline.
I don't know.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, yeah. I could, or there's the fifth option where I could monetize it in, you know, I can sell indulgences through the app, which some of my friends have recommended.
Whoa.
but I would never do that. But what I used to do is I would answer and be like, hey, oh, I'm, you know, really empathetic. Like, I'm really sorry to hear that. I'm not a pastor. You should go talk to your local priest or pastor, wherever you are. And I kind of defer to the quote unquote local authorities.
Nice.
And then, but now I get so many emails, a lot of them have nothing, aren't asking for help. A lot of them are just like incoherent. Yeah. And so I don't know, the last while I have a Gmail filter. I don't even see them anymore. They just get archived, and that's kind of how I've dealt with it.
Okay. To push.
It's never even occurred to me to email the app creator though. That
oh, really?
The idea that you could reach. No, that never even occurred to me. I guess I am so jaded against the idea that anyone behind some digital product, that there's anything. I mean, because I've submitted enough job applications to know that when you send out like some form filled thing, it usually just disappears into the ether.
Sure.
So yeah.
I mean, they do have my email address, right? I don't know if that helps somewhat. And right, frankly, right. And I would say Jake and all of us are much more sophisticated than the average iPhone user, right? Like. Because, oh man, and not just me, like talking to other iOS developers, like the emails you get for support from people are just like, Like, do you have like a left brain? Like, what is the problem here? Because people are just like totally clueless. So
yeah.
Anyway.
So I kind of wanted to push back a little bit on the whole guilt.
Please do.
The guilt, no guilt, and when it happened, because at some point, and maybe you have a really good explanation for this, but at some point you sort of doubled down and you started, as the story goes, correct me if I'm wrong, licensing products and upselling Christian literature inside of your app. And this was presumably after it had started making more than the $600 a month threshold of like, oh shit, this is real money. But then you're like, ah, fuck it. This is working out great. I'm just going to like go balls to the wall and see how much more I can I mean, I'm painting into the worst possible light, but I'm just wondering, was guilt entering into the picture when you started like enhancing your business with these upsells, or did it come later, or was it just a conscious decision? Like, you know what? I actually don't care in the long run.
Yeah. Money is a powerful thing. I've mostly just taken an ignore objective, I guess, because, but I mean, I forgot about that whole part, but it's totally true where I attended. Well, it turns out there's one big Spanish Christian publishing conference every year in Miami. Like, who knew? There's a conference for everything. But yeah, I flew out there and walked in not knowing a soul, you know, had my backpack and convinced these publishers to license a lot of their ebook libraries to me. And those were really, I mean, to me, interesting conversations because they would, you know, I had to, how do I say this? They would ask me where I was from. And if I said Salt Lake City, they would think I was Mormon.
Right.
And they wouldn't do business with me. Because
you said you're Christian.
and that was the first person I talked to. I had that conversation. And I was like, I told him what I did and what I was looking for from him. And he was all excited. And then we had the "Where are you from?" conversation. And he was like, "Oh, it must be hard, you know, doing business out there." And I was like, "Oh, why?" He's like, "Oh, because there's so many Mormons." It's like, "Oh, well, I'm not gonna tell him I'm an atheist." So I was like, "Oh, I'm Mormon." And he's like, oh, yeah, well, I might have to talk to my boss. We might not be able to license our books to you. And so then I couldn't say that I was from – I was from Utah.
Wow.
But then I couldn't say that I was
– Atheist either.
Right. And so it was like multiple levels. Like, for example, that first guy that I talked to that knew that I was Mormon, we still became friends and kind of hit it off. And so later that night we go out to dinner – and we have like this religious debate where I'm like defending all the tenets of Mormonism versus Christianity. So it was, anyways, to answer your question, Bob, I had to transit. So the main problem was at that point I'd been selling the app for, you know, 99 cents or $2, but the app store, and I don't know if you guys have seen this, has shifted dramatically to free apps with in-app purchases.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And so I had to make that switch myself. And the way to do that, the most obvious way to do that was to license content and to create my own content and sell that in the app and just let people download the app for free. And so that was what that was. And I didn't know this at the time, but looking back, if I hadn't done that, I don't think the business would be nearly as big as it is today. I think it would have started to decrease, actually. But it was screw it. Let's just, I'm not even going to think about the dilemma. I'm just going to go. And this is a business deal. And quite frankly, a part of me totally justifies it because if you look into the kind of the Bible industry, what I didn't realize, and this is naive and a lot of people think this way, but it's like the Bible's copyrighted. The Bible's owned, right?
Yeah.
And what translations of the Bible are owned by who? Well, it turns out that the New International Version, the second most popular English translation, is owned. If you follow up the subsidiary chain, is owned by News Corp and Rupert Murdoch, right? And he doesn't give a rat's ass about selling the Bible, right?
Right.
And so it's like, well, fuck it. If Rupert's gonna do it, like, I'm gonna make my six figures and my product is good, right? Like, people like it. I mean, it gets really good reviews, so it's not like I'm swindling people.
Right, exactly. And people, and you're providing the Bible. It's not like you're providing like secret, you know, like switched out verses, like punking people or something.
Yeah,
it's there.
Yeah, and you go to these conferences, and I mean, it's a business, right? Like, I got invited to this breakfast that this company was throwing for all of their distributors, right? And I was a distributor. And they were, you know, they were wining and quote dining us on their like latest goods, and their latest good was, you know, it was, you know, another version of the Bible. In this case, it was like an every man's translation of the Bible, where, you know, it reads like a story in a book, right? And there's, you know, there's not as many verses, and it was like, and they, you know, they had, you know, they had these like, you know, super high production value videos of, you know, talking to pastors and how this new version of the Bible is like, you know, made my congregation so much better. And, you know, they interview couples, and it's like, I mean, they're like marketing this new thing because they have to have new goods to sell, because that's just what businesses do. So that kind of maybe jaded me a little bit, and made me feel better with kind of being a part of the industry.
No, I hear you. I'm wondering, though, if there's a hypothetical, like if I were to give you a hypothetical scenario where you, and I know you've already started another business since this one, but it's more intensive, but just for apples to apples, if you had the opportunity to create another passive income business that requires the same amount of time, makes the same amount of money-ish, at what point would you want to turn off this fire hose because you have another one, and you're turning it off because of some sort of higher moral standard, and your new one has to be the same or twice as much money, or you're a millionaire, or I don't know.
Sure.
Or is it, or do you want to just say for the record, and it's, I don't mean to make it a trick question, it's fine, whatever the answer is, that, you know, you're already beyond that.
It's beyond a question. This is a paragraph.
It's a Bob compound question.
I know. I'm just wondering if morality is still there in some way, like you would turn it off at some point, or if it's like too far gone and it's like, no, that's not the point.
No. So I would never turn it on. I mean, maybe 10 million plus I'd turn it off, but,
okay.
I would sell it before I turn it off. And I've had, since all this publicity that I've gotten on Fox and everything, I've had like multiple acquisition offers and people kind of looking into buying it. And
how did that make you feel? That's gotta be nice.
I mean, the price has got to be right, and it's got to be a pretty high premium because it takes so little of my time.
Right.
But if someone – yeah, if someone paid me enough, I'd absolutely sell it to them.
Okay.
answer to your question, no, I don't feel guilty enough to turn – I mean, obviously, here we are talking about it, to turn it off. And it would take quite a bit for me to do that.
Okay.
Well, I've been afraid to talk for so long, but I've been every time I talk, I seem to drop off. Like the first time I listened to this, because I'm a hardcore skeptic, and one of the things that skeptics fight against is the profitability of bullshit. and I thought, okay, if I could make millions of dollars a year selling faith healing or homeopathy. Or name your bullshit. could I do it? I don't think I could. But what you're doing, I mean, the way that I would justify it is that you're not perpetuating belief in the Bible. You're perpetuating a piece of literature. And by the way, the Bible is one of the most important pieces of literature in the history of mankind. And you're just selling its text. And you know, there's some great books. I mean, there's a lot of bullshit and a lot of crazy shit. And if you live your life by it, like a you know, owner's manual, that's not your responsibility. You know, there's great books like Job and Ecclesiastes. So basically, you're just offering in Spanish a better app than others have provided, a piece of literature that is very important and very good in a lot of ways. And that's how, like, I would justify it.
That is the last thing I expected to hear out of Randy's mouth.
I'm the same way. I'm like so dumbfounded. Like, what?
I was waiting
happened?
For like the fuck you, turn it off. You know, right?
Well, that was my first response, but I thought about it. I've been thinking about it for the last few hours.
And
all you're doing is providing a piece of literature. I mean, it's not the same thing as making claims that of psychic powers.
But
you know,
but at the same time, Randy, you and I talked just briefly right before this call.
Yeah.
What if you subbed the Bible, Trevor, for the Book of Mormon? Would that change things, and why?
Yeah, it's shittier literature, for starters.
Well, the market's not nearly as big, so I'd obviously never do that.
No, but not from that angle. But just like, let's say you're making money in the same way, but it's for this Mormon audience, and it's the Book of Mormon specifically. Would that make you feel worse, better, or the same?
No, that was a dumb joke that I was making. But no, I don't think I'd feel nearly as guilty, actually, because
really?
Wow, I was.
I'd feel worse.
No, because most Mormon people are doing fine, right? Like.
Oh, I see your angle. Okay.
Like, I mean, they already paid 10% to some black hole that builds walls, right? Like, they can.
Black hole. I've never heard it described quite like that. That's
kind of true, though.
Yeah. So no, I wouldn't feel. I don't think I'd feel bad. It's almost kind of like cathartic. Like, oh, at least I'm getting something back from the portion of my life that they took from me.
Okay.
Like small revenge.
My
right,
like
right. And you get to feel a little bit more authentically part of the. You know, at some point you were more a little
sure.
more authentically part of that group of people or how they self-identify. You know what I mean? Whereas with the Christian groups who are so suspicious of Mormons in the first place, it's
yeah.
like you're a double outsider. You know?
Exactly.
Right.
What were you saying, Bob?
Oh, I analogy of mine sort of backfired. I thought that was, and this is going to be a complicated one for you, Trevor. And you're like, no, it's no big deal at all.
Yeah, he swatted out of the lane.
Yeah.
Nope. So I agree. Like with Randy, that yeah, it's you know it's a better product. It's something that's already out there. They get it another way. But it's like there's kind of like a you know there's a spectrum of bullshit profitability things out there, right? Like. On one extreme, you have, the things you're talking about, the like psychotherapy, but therapeutics, all you know, all the DoTerra company in Utah, right? And then like maybe kind of in the middle, you have like the Rush Limbaughs of the world, right? Who are saying things that are like obviously false to get like an emotional reaction out of people,
mm-hmm.
To build up an audience to which they can sell things, but it's not entirely bullshit. And then maybe further
it's pretty close to entirely, but anyway.
No, it's
well,
like 90,
I mean, okay,
90%.
I mean, I'm just saying there's like a spectrum, right? And then a little further
right.
along, maybe you have like me. And the best analogy that I've given, and this probably disagrees with what you said, Randy, and I said this in the one podcast, but like it's almost like if I sold Harry Potter books, but I told people it was real. And you know, people can, especially with religion, you know, people can cast spells that they're wizards. They can cure their children if they, you know, if they follow the rules of the book, right? That's how I described growing up in Mormonism, thinking I was a wizard my entire life, and then finding out that not only was I not a wizard, but I wasn't even like a muggle. Like, there's no such thing as muggles or wizards. They're just normal people.
Right.
And anyway, that's probably a darker interpretation of what I do, but I think it's a. It's everyone's favorite quote from other podcast. I'll tell you that.
Well, I see. I feel like that would be the case if you were selling like the indulgences or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, that's true.
But at this point, I mean, they're just interacting with something that I mean, you're not perpetuating the belief system. You know, you don't have to. I don't know at what point are you. Why would you have to be responsible for all the baggage that comes along with a belief system just because you? Are providing people access to the primary text.
Well, the answer to that is that don't you make most your money, and I'm just playing devil's advocate here, but don't you make most your money from licensing pop Christian literature that's kind of sucky and not as, you know, historically relevant to Randy's apologetic answer of like, oh, the Bible is such a wonderful.
No, I didn't. Come on, man. I mean, I
know.
There are parts of the Bible. It's a piece of literature.
Sure,
it's,
but not the stuff he's making money off of that's like the pop culture spin on it that's licensed deals inside the app. That's the upsell, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, most of my money is made from the audiobooks of the Bible that I own.
Okay.
And so I guess that's listening to good literature. I don't know. But,
sure.
But yeah, we do make a decent chunk from these Christian books, and they.
Oh,
you know,
that changes everything.
See, I'm trying to help Randy.
Oh
out.
My God.
And they do. I mean, well, I mean, maybe
I've been in and out. I haven't heard everything.
Well, the first time we talked about this, and they range the whole gamut. Like, there's some, you know, higher quality ones, and there's the other ones that, you know, they kind of just push out there because they want to have more products to sell people. They just sit there and sometimes I think I'm taking them out just because I split the revenue 50% with the publishers and I'm like, you know, is it worth it? Should I just focus on my audio Bibles? I don't know, but that's a fair point, Bob. I quote unquote should feel more guilty about selling those books.
Yes, you should. No, I'm totally flipped.
It's a very black and white world. Yeah.
Hey, come on now.
What do your active Mormon friends and family think of this whole story? And now that it's gotten some press, and do you talk to them about it, or is it just like everything else, Mormon, you know, believer versus non-believer, and you just avoid it?
It was amusing that, like, it was, you know, even though it didn't really affect my business at all, it was still kind of an ego boost, pat on the back to get all this publicity. It was a fun moment for me. And so, like, everyone was happy for me except for my immediate family. Some people will sometimes make the remark on Facebook. They'll be like, oh, but you've been so blessed by your mission. Obviously, like, it's so obvious to people that, like, it, you went on a Spanish speaking mission and now your Spanish language, company is making money. But it did. And I was really actually happy about this. It did kind of force the hand of a religious conversation with my dad, which I've basically haven't had since I left the church. And so we got to, like, basically I told him that he'd had my entire life to convince me of his point of view, and I'd never had a chance to convince him of mine. And so we talked for maybe an hour about that. And that was good. I'm glad that happened, even though his beliefs are crazy. and more important, his reason for believing, they're just insane and almost scary. But I was still happy to kind of to be able to kind of just talk to him for once. For the most part, the reaction has been silence from family. My mother-in-law did leave in tears voicemail to my wife,
we
love you and we hope you'll come back type thing. And that was probably the worst, the lowest moment. But other than that, it's been mostly silence.
That's the unintentional patronization of the Mormon believer.
Yeah, I don't.
You didn't know what I meant?
No, I don't.
Oh, we still love you, or, you know, we accept you.
Yeah.
Even though what you're doing is so
you're a bad
insidious
person.
And doing so many harms, so much harm to so many souls, we still love you.
Yeah.
That's what I meant by patronization.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I mean, in defense of my mother-in-law, she's actually really nice, and I really like her. And I mean, she's devastated that I've brought her, her daughter out of the church. But that's a fair point.
Right. Well, so. I kind of wanted to wrap up with talking a little bit about Fox News, because, you know, why not?
Another legitimate source of information.
Right, right. Yeah. So they picked this up, and we've got a great clip from them.
You know, it's all about the smartphone. You know, you can, with this phone, you can do pert near everything.
So what's happening with this guy?
Well, this guy named Trevor McKendrick is an app creator. There he is right there. He founded Back Office and Salem Software. And then in 2012, he came out with his first app. It was a Spanish Bible for the iPhone. And in the beginning, he didn't sell many. But then he made it into an audiobook. And it really took off. And now he's six figures per year selling this. Bibles. Here's the thing. He's an atheist selling Bibles. He's a capitalist, but he's an atheist selling Bibles.
And this is how he explains it. Watch.
It's like, what if you sold Harry Potter books or Lord of the Rings books, but you told people it was real, right? And you told people that they could cast spells, that they could heal their children. And if you sold that as if it was a real thing, I mean, I would feel terrible about that. But that's really the situation that, from my perspective, I am in selling the Bible. Like, I am selling this thing that I truly believe is fiction, but other people are trying to use and mold their lives to fix, you know, large and small problems.
Wow.
Getting rich selling fiction.
He sure is. So a family member was actually selling apps, and he thought, wait a second, I could make $5,000 to $6,000 a week or a month. That sounds like a good idea. He started doing this, and these are the Spanish Bibles, La Biblia Reina, La Sagrada?
Sagrada.
Biblia, and Citas y Más Citas.
Right. I haven't seen those words since I was at El Torito, but I will say this.
But they're working.
I actually have no...
access to them.
You do? Right. I have no problem with this.
Yeah.
Because he is helping Spanish people who want Spanish language Bibles with a better app, so they're getting what they want. He saw a softness in the market and capitalized on it. He's not hurting anybody, so I have no problem with this.
As long as he's not messing with any of the details in what he's putting out there in the apps, and you assume that all the information is as it is in the Bible and in Word, I think it's great with the availability.
So you agree with me?
No, but I think
okay, fine. No, that's okay.
I do agree with you, because I think the availability is great, and it's putting it out there to a market in need.
And then they have a Facebook page where they asked all their listeners, go, you know, comment and share your opinion and what do you think. And Fox News, their response was pretty benign. I forget her name, the new blonde in the middle of the two guys. But I guess all three of them were just like, hey, it's totally fine. We like it. I mean, it's, you know, as long as he's not changing things in the text, it's just a great way to show that the good word can be spread and capitalism at the same time. We like both things and awesome. Case closed. But then in the comments, you've got like two different flavors. You've got the one set of people who are like, you know, God uses everyone, whether they know it or not, or he doesn't mm-hmm. even know he's working for Jesus. And then on the other side, you have the other extreme, which is like, this dude's a genius. He's just doing a religion has done all this time, which is scam people. And I'm just wondering, did you actually try to engage or comment, or did you just sort of like passively watch this? And is there any reason? Because it's kind of like both sides are not quite right, but they both have some bit of truth. I learned
that I had friends who watched Fox News because they're the ones that told me I was even on it. Because yeah, if you're watching Fox News, you're probably not. I mean, there's something missing there. But
right.
So a couple days before, so the reason Fox News picked it up is because Business Insider wrote up the original podcast and made a blog post out of it.
Right.
And then that got picked up like literally thousands of other sites. And then from all of that, Fox News saw it and aired it. And so the only reason I say it is because with the original Business Insider post, I kind of tried to engage with people, and I was like, oh, hey, you know, Trevor McKendrick here. They're right about me. Like, okay, good comment. And I was like super friendly and just comment here and there. And then people didn't really respond, or I don't even know, but nothing really happened. And so then that was a Wednesday. Thursday, it blows up everywhere on the internet. I'm like, oh, well, I don't even know where to go to contribute here. And then it hit Fox News on that, I think it was Friday. And it was just like, I mean, you saw all the comments. It was just like, no, like, what about, it was like, you know, Moses trying to part the Red Sea. It was just not going to happen. Jake, it sounds like you said you read 300 plus of the comments. I don't even think I read that many. And they actually Fox News posted on their Facebook page twice, because they have one for all of Fox News and they have one for the Fox and Friends show in the morning. Right. And it was, I don't know if you saw both, but it was interesting because they're, of course, all of the headlines are super inflammatory and very emotional, but the more one of them was much more emotional and over the top than the other. And the comments in the post very much reflected that, which I thought was interesting. Bob, you hit the nail on the head. It was like most people saying that God works in mysterious ways, and then you had like the token non-believers who are for some reason watching Fox News who stuck up for me. I was with the 2-minute clip on Fox News. I thought I was super happy about it. Actually, I was like, oh, you know, capitalist point of view, he's just providing a better product. Great. If that's what I'm going to get out of Fox News about selling the Bible, I don't know if I could do better than that.
That's a pretty good endorsement, actually. It could have been a lot worse.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. I feel like they were very, I mean, you know, they definitely didn't try and like smear you or put you in a negative light. So that's a huge positive.
Yeah, I almost like shit my pants when my buddy because I didn't know about it. They obviously didn't contact me, and my buddy was like, "Hey, I was leaving work this morning. I saw your face on Fox News," and I was like, "Oh my God in heaven, what are they saying about me on Fox News?" And then quickly, you know, scoured the internet to try and find a clip. Didn't find it till later that afternoon and watched. I was like, oh, okay. That wasn't, you know, nearly as bad as it could have been. So, yeah, I thought it was what you just said, Jake.
Yeah.
Cool. So, Trevor, anything else you want to cover or mention? I mean, we've run the gambit. I've covered everything that I was interested in.
I'm trying to think of anything else. Yeah, no, it's been quite the ride writing the Spanish Bible business. I will say this. So the original podcast was in a podcast called Startup, by one of the producers of This American Life. And when I reached out to them, they asked for stories about people's businesses. And so I reached out and I said, I'm a Bible salesman, sort of. And I kind of give them my quick 2-minute story.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew when I reached out to them that I knew what their demographic and what the size of their audience was. And I was comfortable with kind of exposing myself to that audience.
Right.
But then when it got picked up with all these other places, that was, you know, that was like, it was a little, I don't know if scary is kind of overdoing it, but basically for the rest of my life, for the rest of the internet, I'm going to have like the atheist label next to me. And I don't know quite how I feel about that. I mean, because I would personally, if I had to describe myself right now in general, I'd say somewhere between atheist and agnostic, being agnostic, just because I'm kind of jaded by the certainty of Mormonism to call myself atheist, I guess.
right. It's another certainty you don't want to swap out for, so to speak.
Yeah. I was like, well, you can't really be certain about, you know, why the universe exists.
And conveniently, Randy dropped and can't defend anything. So that's
right.
And so that's, I'd say if there's a bad part to all of this, it's kind of like having that next to me. And I mean, frankly, I think over the next 10, 20 years, it's only going to get better. I think there's eventually going to be atheist politicians, and we're always kind of 30 years behind Europe, I guess. But for right now, it's kind of like, well, if the Bible goes belly up and I have to like go find a job, is that going to hurt my career? You know, are fewer people going to do business with me? Like maybe, I don't know. It's kind of just like a downside that I hadn't anticipated. But other than that, it's I've been quite happy with it.
Yeah, that's true. But I feel like you've got enough runway. Religion still has a pretty decent shelf life, even if it's going to lose in the long run. For your lifespan, it's probably fine.
It's not religion that I'm worried about. It's, you know, it's the platform that I'm on. You know, Apple could change their search algorithm. You know, iPhone could, you know, go away, and they're, you know, whatever the next platform is, right? And so I'm very dependent on that, and that's more risk than I would like. And so far it's worked out, but who knows?
Right.
And it seems like it would be a little bit unnerving to have the story that you got to tell on your own terms, going onto that podcast, kind of spiraling out of control, and it gets picked up by Fox News, and they get to do a story about it without ever contacting you, right?
Oh yeah, I know.
That's kind of freaked in. Yeah, and one of those. So I looked at both of the Facebook posts that you're talking about. And one of them was this. It almost looked like a meme, but it was like a headshot of you, and then it had that Harry Potter line,
yep,
printed next to it, and that was the post that they had, and everyone was reacting to that. So that's just, I mean, and that's kind of a deliberately inflammatory caricature of that they picked up. It almost makes you seem like you're like this laughing jackal and saying, "Hi, I'm making money off of you," wherein really what you're expressing is a lot of moral ambivalence and angst about, you know, figuring out how you feel about that type of thing. So I can see how that would be unnerving for that to get spiral out of your what you can control or respond to directly anyway.
Yeah. You hit the nail on the head where, like I said, that's everyone's favorite or least favorite quote. And more broadly, I think it speaks to just like the media and the internet in general, where like the truth is almost irrelevant sometimes, where, you know, it's totally fueled by the godly, you know, the almighty page view.
Right.
So, yeah. And so kind of being in that for my 15 seconds of internet fame was interesting to watch, because I knew when the weekend hit, I was like, this is all going to be gone on Monday and people aren't even going to remember me. But at the time, you feel like this message and your reputation and all this information about you is just like totally uncontrolled, and the truth does not matter, and you know, and what are people going to think? And then it's gone not even a week later. Right. And I would say most, you know, people like ourselves are like aware of that. Like I was certainly aware of, you know, very clickbaity, you know, headlines that aren't necessarily really true, or they don't expose all the nuance. But knowing that and then kind of experiencing it kind of, you know, give a finer point to it. Like, oh, this is I know the 100% truth of this story. And then I'm seeing the media, the Fox News description of it and the reaction thereof. And they're, you know, kind of close, but not really.
Right. It's all telephone.
Yeah, exactly.
So
12 amazing things that happen. Number 7 will blow your mind.
Click here. Yeah. So this may or may not be that interesting to anyone else, but how was it talking with Alex Bloomberg? And did your interview, you know, because for that podcast, the Startup Podcast, it's highly stylized or edited. And did it reflect what you wanted it to, or was it only like, you know, 20% of what you actually talked with him on the phone about?
No, it was so I recorded the interview so I could listen to it later, and my wife and I have listened to it multiple times. It was 45 minutes.
Oh, wow. It's pretty long. And he used like 10 minutes of it at the most.
Yep, yep. And it was – I mean, it was awesome talking to him. I love Alex Bloomberg and This American Life. So that was a lot of fun. His portrayal of our interview I thought was very accurate. I thought it was very fair. I just wish that I maybe hadn't said quite as many inflammatory things as I did in the interview itself.
Mm-hmm. We'll splice that all in just for you.
So you're a Bible salesman.
I am my wife introduces me to her friends as a Bible salesman, yes.
And she does that to be humorous?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. It's very – very not serious.
And why is that a joke?
That's a joke because we don't believe in Christianity. We don't believe in the Bible.
Are you an atheist?
Yeah, I would describe myself as an atheist. Yep.
So you're an atheist electronic Bible salesman.
Unfortunately, yes. I found myself in this awkward situation.
Okay. So, well, let's back up.
At the time I started the business, I was kind of on the cusp of leaving Mormonism. So I was raised Mormon, went to the Mormon college, Brigham Young University in Utah. I got married in a Mormon temple just actually a couple months before the app came out. If I had known how big it was going to be, I don't know if I would have gotten into it, because now with this amount of money, it's like there's like some sort of like moral obligation that I feel like I have. It's just uncomfortable me selling something that I don't actually believe in. Originally, when it was just like this little punk app, it was like no big deal. It's like, oh, who cares if you make $600 selling the Bible? But it's like, oh, you make six figures. It's like, should you be doing that? Like, I don't know. Should I?
It's an interesting conundrum.
It is. Well, because it's like, what if you sold Harry Potter books or Lord of the Rings books, but you told people it was real, right? And you told people that they could cast spells, right? That they were wizards and that this was a real universe. And if they would just learn how to write spells themselves, that they could heal their children when their children were having problems, right? And if you sold that as if it was a real thing, I mean, I would feel terrible about that, but that's really the situation that, from my perspective, I am in selling the Bible. Like, I am selling this thing that I truly believe is fiction, but other people are trying to use and mold their lives to fix, you know, large and small problems.
You have really left the fold.
Oh, yeah. I'm totally gone, dude. I am so far gone.
What happened?
Oh, man. some combination of – oh, man. Yeah, I mean, and I don't know if that speaks to me being just too open or to his ability as an interviewer. I would hope it's the latter. But yeah, when I – because I recorded it. I sent it to my wife who was at work so she could listen to it. And at one point – thankfully he didn't air this, but I compared selling the Bible to like selling porn. It's like, well, it's, you know, it's a better business or whatever or something. And it was like – I'm like, actually, please don't put that in. He's like, oh, no, that's way too inflammatory. We won't include that.
It's funny because there's one part where he asked this question of you where like, so you were Mormon – and you believe, and what happened?
Yeah.
and you didn't really have like the room to, I mean, he gave you a decent amount of airtime, but I could tell that you were like, okay, are you sitting down? How much time? Do you really care?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. It's like, I mean, how much, I mean, we have 45 minutes, man. Like, how much do you want to hear? Because that was what was so, I thought most bizarre about the interview is that we talked about religion for like, I don't know, 35 minutes of a 45 minute interview. And it was like, this is his podcast is about his business. Like not only not my business, not even religion, but his business.
Right.
And so it was like, I don't know what you're going to use, man, but okay, this is like this is my life. And so anyway, yeah, that was, I don't know if you could tell in the actual podcast, but my longest kind of quote in the middle of my bit was highly, highly edited. He had stringed a bunch of different parts and pieces together. And
oh,
I'm
really?
Not gonna ask anyone this, and my wife can't tell because she listened to the original, but like, could you, Bob, could you tell that it was edited or did it sound like it was just me talking fluid?
I assumed it was edited in general, but I didn't see the – I didn't hear the specific themes.
Can't identify it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, that means it's edited really well because when I listen to it, I almost feel – it's not that it's inaccurate, but it's like all these things that I sped – you know, that I said like 10 minutes apart put together, and it's like – I didn't like – I mean – it's like I didn't like the way I didn't say it like that. I mean, I don't know. There's like there's always more nuance, but I thought he was still fair.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I thought it represented you actually pretty well, especially compared to anything else, which was, you know, more the clickbait stuff. His was at least in that sort of, you know, podcast format of just intrigue and a little bit lengthier. I don't know. I think it worked well.
Yeah, no, I thought too. I really liked it. I mean, you know, the night it came out, my wife and I listened to it, and we were like kind of nervous. Is it, you know, Harry Potter? Is it too, you know, too crazy? And then the next morning, I was getting like messages from like very Mormon friends on Twitter who like, hey, heard your podcast, and I hadn't told anyone.
Right, and it's one of those weird things. Do you self promote that, and to which group of friends? And you're like, hey, I was on this podcast. Yeah. It's about the topic that we never talk about. Do you want to listen?
Yeah, I linked to it once on Twitter, like the day or I linked to it like I think once on Twitter and once on Facebook, like a week after it came out. I was just kind of like, I'm just gonna leave this here, and if people want to listen to it, great. And I am kind of nervous having the atheist label. It was like a nice way to just come out to as many people as possible at once.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
It led to me and my wife going out to dinner with an old friend and her husband that I hadn't seen in a couple of years, and they're still totally in the church, and they asked me, I mean, we didn't talk about religion, but they asked about the apps and they were cool with it. And it was like, oh, you know, like a lot of, you know, I have a lot more, I guess, reasonable friends than I realized. So that was cool.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Jake, anything from, I think we're at a decent stopping point, and we've got a nice story here, and we'll make sure to edit it and take you out of context and ruin it for you. But
right, exactly.
No. Well, yeah, this was like a lot of fun, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
So can you just say, like, just some controversial words, like just say like Hitler and like Satan and love and worship, just those four in a row, and then we can
money, Nazism, you know.
How did you, just out of curiosity, how did you find out about Infants on Thrones? How did you hear about us?
The classic John DeLynn Mormon Stories podcast.
God damn. It comes back to him.
and
sick of that answer.
Yeah, I knew that's what I was afraid to tell you. But, and you guys always kind of, at least a couple of times, have talked about, like, your name and, like, should we've named it something else? But we like the name. And it's funny because I actually saw, so there's, like, two parts on your Mormon Stories one. And I was like, Infants on Thrones. And the first thing I thought of was Game of Thrones.
Yeah,
and that was like my association. I was like, I'm like, this sounds weird. I'm not going to listen to it. So I didn't listen to it at first. And then, but what my buddies, he's a closet Exmo, told me about. He's like, because he'd heard of you guys before, and he recommended that I listen to it. So then I did, and you know, I'm a convert and all that fun stuff now. But I guess that name, which I like now, and I totally get where you guys are coming from. I was like, yeah, it's a cool name. But at the same time, it like, doesn't immediately convey the...
it's esoteric.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's good market research.
And way less incest here than Game of Thrones.
Yeah, there's no floppy wiener, floppy wiener, floppy wiener. One wiener next to another.
What? Where is this coming from? I haven't heard this version of the song.
That's a South Park parody of Game of Thrones. It's brilliant. It's a two-part South Park episode. I highly recommend.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. Croquet. My right fist is really sore right now from pounding the table.
Could be sore from other things.
Hey-o.
Hey-o.
One thing on his mind.
And just another annoyingly friendly reminder to go to podcastawards.com and make us the most reluctantly religious, inspirational podcast in the universe today.
Thank you for listening to
Infants on Thrones.
Infants on Thrones.